KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
906-949 KUOW. If you're a Speakers Forum fan, you count on hearing interesting talks by interesting people talking about interesting topics. Why not pledge? The fall pledge drive has been going well. We're nearing the end of it, but if we haven't heard from you, why not right now at KUOW.org? The amount doesn't matter. As little, as much as you're comfortable with, but pledge now at KUOW.org, and thank you.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. WordPress.com is the 15th most trafficked website in the world. It's also a pretty unique workplace. Everyone works from home, employees use blogs and chat instead of email, and there are no schedules. Scott Birken spent a year working at WordPress. He talks about the lessons he learned about leadership and the evolution of business in his new book, The Year Without Pants, WordPress.com and the Future of Work. Birken spoke at Town Hall on September 19th, 2013.
I have a few stories to tell you in talking about this book and this special year that I had, this very unusual, and I don't use the word lightly, I think unique year, which was a year I spent working at a company that does a lot of very unusual things, some of which most people in the working world only dream about, some things that people in the working world are terrified of. So there's a combination of interesting things about this place that I worked. But the subtitle of my book, there's a lot of books that you guys read, you guys are a literate crowd, we're here in Seattle, and a lot of books have an interesting title, and then it seems like a committee of bureaucrats got together to figure out the subtitle, and it goes on for like three sentences and includes all these keywords that are good for searching on the web, but you wonder if the author had anything to do with them. I can say that I chose the title of this book, and so the subtitle about the future of work is not some kind of marketing gimmick. And the title of the book, WordPress.com and the Future of Work, is not to suggest that I think all the things that WordPress.com does that I'm going to share with you should be copied or that they are inevitably in our future. So that word "and" is for comparative purposes. And one of the things I'm going to do with, not to you, but with you tonight, is share with you and use the example of my story from WordPress.com to help ask good questions about what work is for and what work should be and what managers and leaders at workplaces are should be held accountable for trying to do. One other pet peeve I have as an author, I've written books about creative thinking and the history of innovation. I hate jargony words and words that are abused. And the word future is an abused word. It's been beaten up and left for dead on the side of the road, and everyone kicks it around whenever they need a cheap, cliche marketing phrase to use. People just say their product is the future of something, or whatever they're selling is the future of something. One failing about that word that's important to think about is no one should use that word without studying history first. Because if you're going to look at future, that means today is the history of that future. And history gives you even more data because that's looking further backwards in time. So you can never possibly feel, you should never feel confident about talking about the future until you have some context from history. So one of the things that I did in preparing to write the book was spend some time reading about two things. First, the history of work itself, but also the history of people who proclaimed the future of work and how wrong they were, which by and large, we are horrible at predicting the future of anything. And anyone who calls themselves a futurist or a visionary thinker, you should ask them for some data to make a list of all the things they proclaimed the future of and then a record of how well they did, because odds are they did pretty badly. I'm not going to give you a list of those things because that would be a different book and a different topic, and that's not what you came here for. But I can tell you why there's this picture of a cave painting up on the wall, which is the history of work. If you go back to the beginning of our species and what we did to survive, that was the first work. That's as far back as you can go. And so that work had meaning. If you didn't do that work, you died. And all of your ancestors, all the way back on the family tree, going as far back as we can measure or record, those cousins and uncles, who didn't want to do that work, they're dead. They are not here anymore. Did not work. The work did not work. So we know that work, when it began, the whole notion of extending effort to achieve some means had real, the deepest possible meaning possible. So the first meaning, the first work was meaningful. And then if you look at the grand history throughout civilization, little by little, a lot of that meaning, especially in professional work, in knowledge work, in information work, a lot of that meaning has gone away. And we work in jobs that pay us well to do things that don't satisfy us, really. And sometimes we think maybe that's why we're paid a lot, to make up for what our soul doesn't get. We have to find that on our own outside of the workplace. But we should all start from the baseline. The beginning of work itself enriched us. That was something we felt rewarded. It had the best, highest possible meaning that you could have. My second story for you sets up the book. So I worked at Microsoft for about a decade. I was a project manager guy. I led a lot of teams on different things. And then I left the company in 2003 because I wanted to find something more meaningful to do. And for myself and my own view of the world, I could not think of anything more meaningful to do than to write, or at least to figure out if I could write and if I could find a way to make a living doing that. So from 2003 to 2010, that's what I did. I wrote 4 books, and they were popular enough that I could make a living doing that in combination with speaking. And those books are largely about the things that I did: creative work, how to lead people, how to make good decisions. Eventually, I wrote about public speaking, since I do that a lot. But eventually, I realized that I was becoming one of these people that I used to hate, one of these experts who's making predictions about the future or offering advice to people about stuff that they don't do anymore. If you think of all the experts in any field that you're interested in, the people who are the most well-known and visible for being experts, in air quotes, for being experts, are the people who spend the least amount of time actually doing that thing. Now, that's not to say that their services provide no value, but there's good questions you should ask of any guru or any expert. But how do you know this works? When was the last time you, Mr. or Mrs. Expert, actually went and did this yourself, and what were the results? So I had this voice in the back of my head that I was becoming one of those people. So I had an open mind about the prospect of returning to work and trying to figure out how much of my own advice, how much of what I preached to other people and got paid money to preach to other people, how much of that did I actually follow? That's where WordPress comes in. So WordPress is software used to publish on the web. It's very, very, very popular. About 20% of all websites in the entire universe, the entire web, use WordPress. That's something like 70 million websites. That's an amazing, staggering number. Huge, enormous. WordPress.com, which is the corporate entity, it's a more controlled, actually run service that does even more for you than WordPress itself does. WordPress.com, which is where I was offered a job by the founder, Matt Mullenweg, gets 4 billion page views a month. That's 130 page views a day, which is currently the 8th most popular website in the world. Seemed like a good place to try to practice what I've been preaching. This is a successful company. It's been around for 8 years. Regardless of their methods, however strange they are, which I'll talk about in a second, they're clearly doing something well enough to achieve this phenomenal, almost unheard of level of success. Some of those strange things include the fact that no one uses email at WordPress.com. And that's not some corporate decree that the executive says, no more email, and everyone goes, oh man, how are we going to do this? And no, it's just by habit. So everyone gets an email account, but almost no one uses it. Just think about how much email you get a day and how frustrating that is and how your work experience might be like without it. It's even hard to imagine. I remember it was hard for me to imagine. I thought that it was probably some kind of lie, that maybe they made up their own version of email called like WordPress email, and it was like a gimmicky trick. There's also the most famous thing they're known for in terms of unusual work practices is one of the meanings of the title of my book, The Year Without Pants, and that is that everyone works remotely. So there's 170 or 180 employees at the company now. Everyone works remotely, and that means you can work from anywhere you want. If you are cruising the world on some ocean liner and you're sitting by the pool every day, as long as there's good Wi-Fi and you do your work, that's great. Some people even join the company and then decide to sell their condo or move out of their apartment and just travel for 6 months because it does not matter. So everyone works remotely. Generally, if you haven't gotten the gist of this already, there are very few rules. Most of what goes on is about what you produce. And it's up to you as an employee, as an adult, to figure out what you need to do to be the most productive. It's not a lot of rules every day, what you're supposed to do now, when the meeting is, or there's no product review, strategic review with a bunch of executives every week to figure out who's going to get budget and all. There's none of that. You are empowered, you're an employee, you're expected to go and figure it out for yourself. Lastly, and we're getting closer to my part of the story, at the time I was hired, there was no management. It was all people who had individual special roles, programmers, designers, writers. There was no management structure at all. There weren't even teams of people. The last thing is about the open vacation policy. You can see this list goes on and on. It's actually much longer than the one that I've gone through already. The general sense was, for me anyway, is this the future? This is all very liberal and very open-minded and very chaotic. Is this good? Is it better to have this much freedom, or does this create more problems than it solves? Those were some of the big questions that I had before I even joined. And I wanted to use my own personal goal of seeing how much of what I had been preaching that I practiced, I wanted to find out that, and this seemed like a great opportunity to ask much larger questions about work itself. Some other big questions that tie into this have to do with the epidemic failure. That's also an overused word, by the way, epidemic. The epidemic failure in management in the working world. I pay a lot of attention to these statistics that get published. Most studies that are published make enormous claims, much larger than what the actual data supports, so I read them very carefully. A good study that was published recently by Gallup was focused on engagement, how engaged people at work felt, and it was about U.S. workers. And that study said 70% of American workers are not engaged at work. And of that number, about half were actively disengaged. Think about having an actively disengaged brain surgeon. Actively disengaged. That means they're not even faking paying attention. Actively disengaged. That's 30 to 40% of our workforce self-reported anonymously that. But what does that mean? I mean, that means something's very broken, but who's responsible for that? Now, I look at this as a management problem. I know from all the lousy jobs I've had in my life, I've worked as a waiter, I've done telemarketing, I've done direct mail, I've done a lot of jobs that in the surface of the work itself was not appealing, but some of those jobs were still fun. There was still engagement, and that was based on my relationship to the people I worked with or the people I worked for. So I think there's something very broken about the present of work and how most people feel about the work that they do. There's something very broken. If you go further back into history, you can make a direct line between this lack of engagement and the history of modern workplaces at all. There's a guy named Taylor who is famous for doing these time and motion studies where he measured people's work in Industrial Revolution-style workplaces. And the goal of management was to optimize them to get as many widgets per minute as possible. There was no creativity or ingenuity required to be a worker then. And as flawed as some of Taylor's methods were for collecting that data, some of his assumptions were true. If you're doing menial or repetitive work, the only thing to optimize for is quantity. You're not looking for people to reinvent the system. So there's this joke that, it's not a joke really because it's not that funny, but there's an anecdote that about assembly line kind of work, that you can create an assembly line and hire people who are really great at working on the assembly line, but the skill set for working great on the assembly line is never going to lead to someone who can create the thing that will replace the assembly line. So it's a limited dead-end prospect. And so much of what goes on in the business world today is focused on change and innovation and trying to progress things. But our management culture, all of the MBA schools in the world, or at least many of the ones in the United States, are born out of this model of thinking. You can actually go and look at the history of most of the popular business schools. They're all born of the Industrial Revolution era, of banks and railroads and big oil. Those are the people who paid for the birth of business schools, with this management-centric view of what work was, which may have worked back then, but as work has changed, that management philosophy, my hypothesis is clearly shows that philosophy, is broken today. And that engagement statistic is part of what shows that it's broken. The last statistic I want to share with you is about remote work, which is one of the big questions that comes up around the book and around WordPress.com. I don't think it's that huge of a deal, but for many people it is. The general trend right now is that more remote work is happening. Currently today, about 20% of all workers who register themselves as full-time workers, 20% of them work remotely. I don't know if that seems like a lot or a little to you. Part of why I don't think remote work as a concept is such a big deal is we've been doing remote work for decades. Anytime you pick up the phone to call someone that's not sitting next to you to talk about work, guess what you're doing? You're doing remote work. You've been doing remote work for decades. The more time you spend on your phone with family and friends, punching in things on a mobile application, guess what you're doing? That's a remote friendship. That's a remote family relationship. We do it more and more every day. And if you think of those things as real relationships that function to a certain degree, same thing is true for work. The technology and tools are rarely really the problem.
Scott Birkin, the author of The Year Without Pants, WordPress.com and the Future of Work. He spoke at Town Hall on September 19th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to KUOW.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at KUOW Speakers. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Scott Birkin in a moment, 923-949-KUOW. Congress passed a last-minute spending bill to end the partial government shutdown and temporarily lift the debt limit. Later tonight, we're going to hear a conversation about how the deal happened and what the crisis could mean for the future of the U.S. political process. That's the Diane Rehm Show tonight at midnight. Forecast for tonight, lows in the 40s, partly cloudy this evening, then becoming mostly cloudy, some patchy fog after midnight, too. Friday highs around 60, cloudy with areas of fog in the morning, then becoming mostly sunny. Speakers Forum is here because of pledges, largely, and if we have not received yours, what are you waiting for? Go ahead and go online now at kuow.org. It's quick and easy. Probably the hardest part will be deciding exactly how much you want to pledge. And that's not all that difficult either, usually, with most of us, I think. Your pledge is mostly what makes this show possible. If you're a fan, you find yourself listening fairly regularly, if not every week, put a pledge behind it. KUOW.org. Thank you.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. What's it like to work at WordPress.com? Everyone works from home, no one uses email, and new improvements go live every day. Scott Birkin knows firsthand, and he's written a book about how this type of workplace could be in everyone's future. Birkin spoke at Town Hall on September 19th, 2013.
So to sum up all my big questions and actually talk to you directly about my story and what happened and what I learned, there's another list of questions that all of this theory building leads to about the workplace. How many other assumptions do we have about what goes on at work that are just made up, that have no real basis in making people more productive or happier? Things like the 9-to-5 workday. That was born out of a certain need technologically because of electricity, because of all these functional purposes, why people needed to work at the same time and in the same places. But is that true anymore? That's a really good question. It's a good question you should ask every time you're stuck in traffic at 8:30 when everyone's jammed on the highway at the same exact time, all to show up at work at 9:05 or hopefully at 9 o'clock. It's a really good question. Is this really necessary? That's a great question to ask about anything that causes you pain or frustration that you're being forced to do. Is this really necessary? How does this make you more productive? Same thing is true about dress codes. I have yet to see a scientific study that says wearing a tie makes you smarter. I have yet to see a study that says wearing a suit or any of these things that we assume to be necessary and true. That's not to say that they don't have value. I'm not a radicalist saying, you know, take off your clothes, go to work naked. I don't have that kind of militancy. But I believe in the questions. And right now in the workplace, there's a lot of these questions we don't even ask. And then once they are asked, the answer is, that's the way we've always done it. That's the way we've always done it. That is the stupidest, worst answer in the history of wisdom. That's the bottom rung of the barrel, because there's no substance behind it. You could do something stupid for a very long time, and you'll defend it forever saying, well, that's the way we used to do it. Enter my time at WordPress.com. So what you see here is my team, circa 2010. It's a bunch of people sitting in what looks to be an ugly, poorly furnished apartment with bad lighting and someone who doesn't know how to make right angles when they frame paintings. That's what you see. And you see three people sitting down working on their laptops. They could be doing anything. This could be a bunch of college students on vacation. It could be anything going on. It turns out it's my team. And my team worked on WordPress.com, and our job was to update the quality and the design of how different parts of the blogging software known as WordPress, how it actually functioned, trying to make it easier to use, trying to make it easier to write, trying to help bloggers get more attention, more traffic, and produce better content. That's what our job was. But we could be anywhere in the world. And it turns out that where we were was Athens, Greece. Why were we in Athens, Greece? It's a good question. The answer is, we could go anywhere. I asked my boss, where should we go? He said, Greece is a great place this time of year. Why don't you go there? And before he changed his mind, I said, all right, we're going to Greece. The additional truth is that of the three people who are on my team, one of them lived in Ireland, one of them was from Australia, and one of them was from California. So we looked around at the globe and said, where can we go that's somewhat equidistant in some arguable way? We'll go there. So we spent a lot of time working in places we had never been before. And actually, in this picture, this was the second time I'd ever been in the same room with these guys. My question in all of this was, how do I, as a manager with these three people who clearly seem to be doing very well on their own without leadership or authority or a mission statement, how do I provide value to them? How do I add to the quality of work being done or to their engagement at work? My question for me, that was my challenge, how do I do that? How do I figure that out? And the answer was, well, the more formal version of the question, I actually wrote this down, I'm a writer, and I knew that I might end up writing a book about this, so I wrote it down, was, how do you introduce team structure into a young, non-corporate culture of chaos and autonomy? And I use the word question strongly, because the answer could have been, might have been, that you can't. One of the prospects of me taking this job was, and I talked to Matt Mullenweg, who was the founder of WordPress and my boss, was, I said to him before I signed on the dotted line, I'm like, this may be a complete disaster. And he was like, I know. I know. And part of me was like, I know too, because the more of a disaster that happens, the better a story there is to tell. And honestly, the more lessons there are to learn. Smooth sailing never teaches anyone anything about sailing. It's only when things get weird and things don't go right that you pay enough attention to actually learn something better. So think about it for a second. What would you do if you were me, or even if you were you? Which is probably an easier way to think about this. You guys all, most of you seem experienced. You've been around for a while. You have an idea of what good managers do. What would your approach be if you were put into this environment? And maybe part of your approach is you're thinking, there's some things, these freedoms, that can't possibly be productive. I'm going to have to rip some of that out. Or maybe you're thinking the other way, that maybe you'd be a better manager if you just went with the flow. My answer that I came up with had two pieces to it. And they were very unconventional pieces. I didn't offer some management theory. I didn't talk about Six Sigma or some management method out of a consultancy playbook. I didn't think any of that stuff really would have merit. Instead, I had two answers, and they were clarity and trust. Two very small, simple words. That if I could earn their trust to whatever I had to do that, if I could show them that I was smart and could make good decisions and could give them good feedback on whatever they were doing independently, then eventually I could be trusted by them to take on a leadership role and make tough decisions and make bigger decisions. And the second piece was clarity. Clarity is just a beautiful word. It's an easy word to say, but rarely is it justified in workplaces. Is this clear? Do I know what I am doing and why? Getting back to that engagement statistic, I think that's a huge part of why that answer is so abysmal. Do I know what I am doing and why? Other than because my boss told me to. That's almost as bad as we're doing this because we've always done it. So I thought if I could provide clarity, here's our goal, and here's all the non-goals, here's all the things we think we should do, but really are distractions. Here's the three important things we need to focus on. If I could provide those two things, I would naturally become a trusted leader of the team, independent of everything else. It didn't matter that I was 12 or 13 years older than the people I was working for. I'm 41 years old. The average age on my team, I think, was 25 or 26. So I was a generation or three quarters of a generation older than them. I thought I could transcend that. I could transcend the fact that I wasn't a programmer. I'm not a programmer by trade. I'm not a WordPress developer. Most of the people hired the company. I thought if I could do these two things, that my team would learn to appreciate the value I could add to their work. One of the fundamental questions I'm sure that you have that I want to answer before my time is up and we open the floor for questions is some specifics about how the day functioned. Given all of my experience with project management and leadership and all that stuff, all that theory and all the books I've read and all the things I've studied about how different historic projects have been managed, I find all that stuff fascinating. How bridges are built, how the space shuttle launches, I find all that stuff fascinating. But when it comes down to daily work, especially in an unstructured environment, it becomes about very simple things. What is the day? What is the week? What is the month? That was my anchor point for creating a language and dialogue about project management. It was just the calendar. It's Monday. Where do you want to be by Friday? And in an environment that's not corporate, that's a very easy way to talk about structure. So one of the first things I did was just set up a weekly meeting. Imagine that. I had to invent a weekly meeting. This was a breakthrough. This was a step forward. But it was. There was resistance about it. And anyway, let me walk you through a little bit about how some of these questions I offered at the beginning about how work is actually done. So instead of email, which is the primary communication method in most modern knowledge-based workplaces, there are three tools that are used at Automattic. Automattic is the company. WordPress.com is the actual product and service, so forgive me if I mix those two things up and go back and forth now and then. There were three tools that are used instead, and these are not fancy, high-tech, amazing, customized tools. Two of these tools are free. Actually, I think all three of them are free, and they're widely available. The three tools they use are something called IRC, which is Internet Relay Chat, which is ancient. I use this in college. I use this in some cases, I think. I was using this before some of the people who worked with me on the team were in elementary school. This is old. The second tool is Skype, and the third tool is blogs. So IRC is Internet Relay Chat. It's just chat rooms. So if you work at WordPress.com, doesn't matter what time you're working or what time zone you're in, one of the few rules that exists, and it's even not that it's not enforced draconianly, like no one's going to slap you on the wrist when you don't follow it, but it's implied. Whenever you're working, be in IRC. IRC, this chat room, is the equivalent of your hallway. That's how you see all the other people who may be working at the time. That's the place you go to when you have a random question. If you're looking for someone, you don't know if they're online or not, you can go in there and go, hey, have you seen Fred? And people, whoever's working will answer your question. It is the hallway, and it functions much the same way. Sometimes it's purely serendipitous. Sometimes people are talking about the weather or sports or politics. Sometimes there's a problem with WordPress.com that requires multiple people to help with. All just chat in IRC. So that's the hallway. The second thing is Skype. Skype is just instant messaging. Also an old technology. It's been around for 15 years. Skype is the current popular flavor of it. And Skype was the equivalent for me as a lead and for people on the teams that formed around the time I was hired for one-on-one communication. If I want, hey, are you done with this yet? Are you going to be done on Friday? Can we have a conversation? That's Skype. And sometimes we'd have our team meetings in Skype. Sometimes we'd have our team meetings in IRC. There were no hard rules about which tools you used. There was a general preference for using IRC, this chat room program, because it was logged. And by logging, I mean it's recorded, which sounds terrifying, especially these days with NSA, anything recorded, who knows where it's going. The idea behind why it's recorded is simply technological. That means that a week later, or a month later, or a year later, or if I get hit by a bus, or if everyone on the team, when they were in Greece, I don't know, got attacked for walking around pantless and were in the hospital, there's a public record, public meaning inside the company, record of all of our conversations. People can go back and see, what did we decide then? How did we come to that decision? It's all recorded. So people are encouraged to do stuff in IRC. Now, the third thing is all the way, you can see it all the way on the right, it's a blog. It's a special kind of blog. This is like a shocking idea, right? A blogging company uses blogs to communicate. You know, radical. Who would have imagined? It's a special kind of blog that's built for team interaction. And a blog is just a website, so this is just a very easy to publish to website where you go to the view of the blog for your team, the P2 as they're called, that's the name of the theme for your blog, and you type in whatever you want. So I, as a team lead, would often have lists of things that needed to be done. One joke I have about being a manager or a leader, being a good one, is all that I do is make ordered lists. That is it. 20 things we could do. Everyone's debating which ones do we do. My job is to put them in order, in ranked order. We do this first, we do this second, we do this third, we do this fourth, we do this maybe if we have time, and here's the stuff we're never ever going to do because it's just dumb and stupid. That is the job of a good leader, to put things in order. And you can think of any meeting or conversation or stupid debate you've ever had in the workplace. Often what's needed is someone who is good at putting things in the right order. So whenever I, as team lead, had a list of things that needed to be done, I'd go here and say, hey, here's the six things. And then we'd have commentary, just like on a blog, all the blogs you read, about who's going to do it or why or what the alternatives should be. That was where all the stuff that you email around documents and links to things, hoping to be a conversation around it, that's where all that stuff lived. The huge surprise to me was how magical it is to invert the prospect of how work communication happens. One of the major failings with email as a technology is that your inbox is a victim. Anyone can put stuff in it. And you all know the coworkers you have who put way too much of the wrong stuff in your inbox. And you can't do anything about it because it's an inbox. It's not a maybe box. It's an inbox. Stuff is coming in. And all the stuff that we do, filters and rules, it's like countermeasures for that attack. We're trying to protect ourselves from the onslaught. By using a blog to be the focal point of a lot of that communication, not all of it, I've showed you we have chat and almost live sort of conversations, but by using a blog, it works the other way. Not everyone in the entire company had to know what list I was making or what I was doing. The burden is on the employee. If they wanted to know what my team was doing, they'd follow the blog. And they get updates just like you do from all the blogs you follow. You can use all the good tools that exist for reading stuff online because it's through the blog system, the same thing. If they realize that Scott's a bad leader or the stuff that goes on this particular team's conversations are too annoying, they don't have to read it anymore. So it entirely inverts the basis for how communication happens. The burden is on you as an employee. No one's going to stuff your inbox full of flyers and news and FYI stuff that you don't need. Of course, every team had their own ability to customize these blogs that they used internally. There will often be blogs for teams, but blogs for projects. So around the time I was hired, I was employee number 58 at the company. I think on the day that I was hired, there were already 60 or 65 of these things. The ones that became inactive just died and went away, much like blogs do in the world itself. Some people start a blog, they keep it active for a while, and then when interest wanes away, it goes away. It's okay. No need to be optimized about the number of blogs that exist. But there's a lot of customization that would go on, and eventually teams, as the teams got stronger and more developed more of an identity, they'd customize them. So we would do things like if you came to our site, the heading would change, and there'd be a funny picture. And little by little, as these little units of teams inside the company were created, as I told you, I was hired as one of the first managers, but there were 9 or 10 other teams that were created that also had new managers. And this was this large experiment that took place about whether these teams would work. But little by little, these little blogs became a source of pride, a source of a way to identify the team as a structure. And those three guys that I showed you a picture of before, who had never worked on a team before at the company and had their own autonomous identity, little by little, we started to develop a culture and a bunch of attitudes on our own that helped us identify who we were. This tool that we use, this blogging tool, it's actually something that is completely free. And one of the other unique characteristics about working at WordPress.com is that WordPress itself, this amazingly popular piece of software, 20% of the web uses it, as I mentioned before, is an open source project. And what open source means is, among other things, but one of the things that it means is that there's this attitude of sharing. WordPress itself, because it's an open source project, this incredibly important project that is the basis for WordPress.com, this corporate organization, WordPress itself, because of its open source nature, it means that someone can come along and decide to volunteer to add to it or to change it. It's a completely open, transparent project. A lot of the stuff, this was new for me having worked at Microsoft, a lot of the stuff that my team did or worked on was also made available to the open source community. So this tool that's used, this blogging tool that's used for internal communication that replaces a lot of the need for email, it's called P2, and if you do a Google search for, or any kind of search for WordPress P2 theme, you'll find it, you can download it, and you can use it. And there's actually a fair number of companies now that have followed the same model, that do some remote work, they don't use email, and they use P2s instead.
Scott Birkin, the author of The Year Without Pants, WordPress.com and the Future of Work. He spoke at Town Hall on September 19th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at @KUOWSpeakers. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Scott Birkin in a moment, 943, 94.9 KUOW. Forecast says lows in the 40s tonight for the Seattle area. Partly cloudy this evening, then becoming mostly cloudy. Some patchy fog after midnight as well. Friday highs around 60, cloudy with areas of fog in the morning, then becoming mostly sunny. Miloš Karadaglić is Michael Feinstein's guest on Song Travels to play guitar music, including Villa-Lobos and Astor Piazzolla. That'll begin at 10 o'clock, just a few minutes away. Time enough right now to go to a computer, go online, go to kuow.org, make a pledge of financial support. The fall pledge drive has been going well. It should be over sometime fairly early tomorrow, but if we haven't heard from you, now's a great time. Just go to kuow.org to make that pledge, and thanks.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Scott Birkin is the author of The Year Without Pants, WordPress.com and the Future of Work. It's about the year he spent working at WordPress, the 15th most trafficked website in the world. Birkin spoke at Town Hall on September 19th, 2013.
So before I wrap up and open for questions, one thought on my mind is why this story is relevant to you. Why should you care about what goes on at this company? And one of the questions I had while I was there, and one of the questions I'm getting asked now that the book just released this week, is about this notion of interesting but non-replicable. It's this common thing that gets said about new ideas. It's interesting for that particular situation, but how will it scale? How does this scale? I think it's a very American notion that we're not happy unless you can make something mega-sized and make it enormous and make it replicable. Why can't 20 billion people can't do the same thing, how could it be good? It's this very strange thing. Because if you think about the very notion of what good is, or great, or exceptional, or genius, or any of these words that we throw around all the time, part of what makes those words mean what they mean is that they are exceptional. They are an exception. There's elements of it that are hard to scale, that once you try to scale it, you take away the exact element that made it good in the first place. So I have this question on my mind that I want to make sure I talk about. Why should you care about this story? Why should you care what they do? And I want to remind you of what I offered you at the beginning, that forget for a moment these specific practices, these specific things that they do. The questions that these things raise are excellent ones for anyone who's unhappy about something they do at work. There's something that needs to change, or something that needs to be done different. And my experience, the fact that they hired me at all was a huge experiment. I did not fit their company culture. I did not fit their company model. The existence of managers made no sense, really, from a lot of perspectives. But they want, certainly, when I say they, I mean Matt Mullenweg, the founder, and Tony Schneider, the CEO of the company, they believe that they don't have all the answers either. And if they don't continue to try new things and be willing to experiment to see what happens if we bring this Birkin guy in, won't that be interesting? What will happen? The worst case is it won't work and we'll get rid of him. What would happen if you tried working with a team without email for a week? What's the worst that could happen? It wouldn't work. You'd notice a few things maybe about how you should use email differently, and then you'd go on. We have so much fear around change and difference, yet at the same time, by all these numbers I'm sharing with you, we have all these really deeply unpleasant things and problems we know are inherent with the modern workplace. That's an incongruity. If you're unhappy about something and you want it to change, but you're resistant to experimenting and trying change, that means you're going to be stuck in the same place forever. And have no one to blame but yourselves, because no one can decide to try something different for you. So I'll leave you with those two statistics that I started with. 70% of American workers aren't engaged. And you need to think for yourself how engaged you feel at work. Or even better, if you're a manager or a leader or an executive, how engaged all the people who work for you are. And who's accountable for that? And what experiments you might need to do to put yourself on a path so 6 months from now or a year from now, there's even any remote possibility at all that you can make that number go up and improve. And so the book is called The Year Without Pants, WordPress.com and the Future of Work. And thank you for listening. Thank you. You're all still wearing pants. And you're awake, which is good. So we have plenty of time for Q&A. As you can tell, I am a jovial, informal guy. You can ask me about anything you want. You guys took time out of your busy Thursday night Seattle schedule to come here. So if there's something you hoped I would talk about, or an important thing you thought I dodged in my talk, anything you were brave enough to ask, I am happy to answer.
I wanted to know about clarity and trust. How did it work?
Clarity and trust.
Yes.
So clarity and trust, I thought of many different ways to try to make that happen. And what I came up with was something very simple and, I don't want to say painful, but disappointing in its lack of magic. There's no secret recipe. If you think of all the people you have in your life that you trust the most, how did that happen? It happened slowly. It happened over time. It happened, you offered them a little bit of trust and it paid off. They did the right thing. You give them a little bit more trust and they respected that and did the right thing. And then eventually, eventually over 6 months or a year longer, you have a lot, someone trusts you a lot. There's no way around that. And it's personal. Everybody has different reasons for why they decide who they're going to trust. So part of why I am a critic of all of these management books and philosophies that paint this brush, that do the six things and everyone will trust you instantly and you'll innovate daily, it's nonsense, because no one's actual personal experience of either of those things works that way. So my answer was, okay, these guys know I don't belong, that they know I don't belong. I told them I don't belong. So my answer was, I'm just going to be the scribe. That's something anyone can do. You pay attention to the conversations. When the conversations are over, you write up a list of what you thought was important, the three or four things that were important, and then a bunch of notes about things that might be important later, and you post it on the blog and say nothing. You don't tell anyone to do anything. Just show in a passive way, look, I am smart and useful. I recorded what you said. I recorded what you said, and it actually sounds like what you said, like you see what I wrote. You're like, yeah, that's what I said. So Scott is kind of honest, and he's intelligent. Okay. When you don't know someone, that's a huge wow. So after 2 or 3 weeks of me just being scribe guy, and then eventually I could be, hey, we should do this, and try to get a little bit more. So the answer was, think of all of your normal human relationships. Imagine that. Think of the workplace as normal human relationships. How do you earn trust? Slowly, patiently, and you have to offer trust to get it back.
So you added honesty and transparency into clarity and trust.
Yes.
Got it. Thanks.
Make a list. Make an ordered list. Unordered lists are night is awful. Criminal.
So maybe you touched on this in your book, but having not read it, I guess I'm wondering what thought you've given to how these kind of philosophies extend to other areas outside the workplace, say like social environments, because that remote kind of nature that you take or approach you take towards your workplace, like going to Athens, Greece, and all these different parts of the world, definitely also impacts, you know, your social life. And you had mentioned, or you touched on kind of how we have these pseudo, you know, relationships that are assisted by, you know, apps and devices. I guess the question is, do you think that there are things that are sacred and that, you know, we can't take that, you know, kind of remote approach to them? Or maybe what are your thoughts on that, how it extends to other social aspects?
The best answer is that this is a technological answer, but it's also a philosophical one, is the way that human beings' cognition systems are built, we get the most data when you're in the same room as someone else. There's just the most data. The most data that will probably never change, despite all the brain implant, neuro, you know, matrixy people. More data, because we're just engineered for it through evolution. This is more data here. How you look, eye contact, your body language, how you smell, hopefully not too bad. There's all kinds of data that we get. So my experience there was, wow, if you have motivated, smart people who are good communicators, you can be a super productive team or organization. The tools are good enough that you can do that. If those three things are true, and a lot of the things I see people complain about remote work, they say, we tried it, it didn't work. This is another cliche, idiotic phrase that's used to justify things. We tried it, it didn't work. You could have tried it with a bunch of monkeys and a moron leading the project, and oh, it didn't work, remote work doesn't work. There's more questions you need to ask before you throw things away. But anyway, my answer is you can be very productive remotely. If you told me I had a choice between starting a rock band with people I could be in the same room with or one that was remote, I'd say I'd want the one that I could be in the same room with. If the only way I could get the really talented people or the people who I know really well was remotely, I bet we could still make a good band. But all things equal, I would choose to be in the same room. Yeah, you're welcome.
Hi. Thank you for coming out, by the way. The topics that you're speaking to feel like they relate directly to the work environment that I'm in, and I really appreciate the tactics that you're taking. My question is, I find myself in a large agency or company setting where I don't have the opportunity to excel and evolve the way that I want to. And I'm like, how do I figure out where, you know, which companies to work for where this innovation is present? I mean, do I Google innovative companies? Do I look for the right keywords in resume and in job postings? Like, you know, I'm seeking out an environment where I can, you know, create or work in the type of environment that you're speaking of. And I'm like, do you have any advice on how to pursue that? Besides working for a small company that can't affect a very large change?
It's a really good question. I think that just the way our job economy is set up, certainly here in Seattle, that there's way more support for creative autonomy at work in technologically based jobs. So I don't know what you do or what your background is, but it's pretty clear that there's way more support for giving people autonomy if they are engineers, designers. That's not to say that that's necessarily good for the future of America or for the future of the world, but as an observation, it's definitely true. I don't know of any auto mechanic shops where this has become a trend that there's now a more autonomous environment. That may be true. I'm saying I don't know about that. Some of that's my own bias because that's the circles that my own background are from. So I'm more aware of companies and organizations that fit those characteristics. But the answer that's in the back of my mind, I was a little bit afraid to say, is that I really believe, this is another unpopular, seemingly obvious answer that most people are afraid to think about, is the best possible way to make an environment that you're productive in is to make it yourself. Mm-hmm. Which is terrifying, requires a lot more work, you don't get a paycheck every week. As a writer who's independently employed, I don't have a pension, but part of why I quit was I wanted control over my time. And I wanted my time working to be with the people who I felt were positive to work with. And the larger an environment I worked in, the more stable it was. It seemed like there was more of that to deal with. So I think that's something for you to think about. Becoming an entrepreneur, given the availability of the web and how cheap it is to market yourself and what you do, no matter what it is that you do. And WordPress is actually part of that. Blogs are free. You can advertise and share any service to the world for free. And in the history of any craft or skill, going back to the Renaissance, we like to think of the Renaissance as this glorious age to be a maker or a creator. That was a horrible time. Horrible. Unless your uncle was the Pope, which is basically like Michelangelo's story, or you were born into a gifted family that had letters where you could go and get commissions. It was horrible. If you wonder why all the art of that age is of the popes and the kings, they're the only people who could afford to pay for that stuff. And today, creation has been democratized. I'm not saying it's easy. I haven't even asked you what you do yet, and it's more mysterious if I don't ask, which is kind of fun. But you can go and find examples of people doing almost anything and using the tools that some of these democratic free technologies have given to create that environment for themselves, or at least to save up enough money to try that for a year. And even if it doesn't work, like I said about experimentation, you'll go through that year, and even if it fails in the parental what are you doing with your life sense, your understanding of what you're capable of and what you really need to be happy will have tripled, quadrupled in ways that you would never be possible if you had someone else to blame, which you always do in the workplace.
Scott Birkin, the author of The Year Without Pants, WordPress.com and the Future of Work. He spoke at Town Hall on September 19th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at KUOW Speakers. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, whose agricultural lands provide a winter migration home and help fight extinction of the North American trumpeter swan. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com. 10 o'clock, KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. I'm Bill O'Grady.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.